Welcome to Talking History and this special Veterans Day program. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In a few minutes, Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik will be talking to Professor G. Kurt Peeler about how the United States memorializes war. But before we do that, let's look back at this week in history. On November 10, 1871, journalist explorer Henry Stanley found missing Scottish missionary David Livingston in Central Africa and delivered his now famous greeting, "Dr. Livingston, I presume." Less well known is Dr. Livingston's reply, "Yes, and I feel thankful that I'm here to welcome you." On November 11, 1933, the Great Black Blizzard carried a mass of cloud of dust into the Great Plains, then dubbed the Dust Bowl. On November 12, 1924, Ellis Island closed after 32 years of service and processing over 20 million immigrants. On November 13, 1789, Benjamin Franklin wrote a letter to a friend in which he made the now oft-quoted remark, "In this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes." And on November 14, 1889, Nellie Bly, a spirited investigative reporter, set out to fulfill a dream inspired by Jules Verne, to travel around the world in 80 days. Bly finished 8 days ahead of schedule. Turning to this week's history in the news, a new study by American Heritage Magazine, published in its October issue, ranks the 40 wealthiest Americans of all time. Surprisingly, only three of the 40 are still alive. Even more surprisingly is that Bill Gates, currently the wealthiest man in America, is only fifth on the list. The honor of wealthiest Americans went to John D. Rockefeller, whose fortune as of 1913 is now equivalent to $190 billion. With a high school education and a talent for bookkeeping, Rockefeller took full advantage of the Allegheny oil boom of the 1860s and founded his own Standard Oil Company. Through shrewd takeovers and creative business arrangements, Rockefeller soon controlled 90% of the nation's oil. Andrew Carnegie, a Scottish immigrant and the second wealthiest American in history, shares a similar story. Instead of oil, Carnegie cornered the market on steel. By 1900, he had risen from his humble position as a telegrapher on the Pennsylvania Railroad to owner and coordinator of the largest steel manufacturing business in the world. Carnegie's wealth as of 1901 would today be worth over $100 billion. Third place goes to Cornelius Vanderbilt, the shipping and railway tycoon, and fourth to John Jacob Astor, who made his proud $78 billion in today's dollars from fur trading and real estate speculation. You're listening to Talking History. Welcome back to Talking History and to our special Veterans Day program. For the principal segment of our show, Dennis Mihalik will be talking to historian G. Kurt Peeler. Dennis?
Thank you, Brian. On November 11th, the United States will observe Veterans Day. It is one of the many ways in which Americans commemorate war. Here today, to explain how and why the nation memorializes war, is Dr. G. Kurt Peeler, research associate and the director of the Oral History Archives of World War II at Rutgers University. Dr. Peeler is the author of Remembering War, the American Way, published by the Smithsonian Press. Welcome, Dr. Peeler.
Thank you.
Let's start right at the beginning. Why do we have a holiday on November 11?
Well, Veterans Day was originally known as Armistice Day, and it marks the anniversary of the end of the First World War. The end of the First World War occurred on November 11th, 1918, and beginning in 1919, Americans began to commemorate the anniversary of the end of the war. And it was known as Armistice Day until the 1940s, when World War I had not become the war to end all wars that many had hoped it would be. And it had been made an official holiday in the 1930s. And in the 1940s, it was redefined from Armistice Day to Veterans Day. And instead of commemorating the end of the First World War and the service of all those who served in the First World War, it was recreated into a holiday that commemorated the service of all veterans, not just of the First World War, but of the Second World War and of the wars that have come since then.
I see. Now, in your book, you argue that memorializing war is important to the creation of the national identity. Will you explain how that happens?
Well, we in some ways, it's an obvious one. We're a country that's been born in warfare. We gained our independence from Great Britain through war. We've sometimes settled our major differences through war, most notably the Civil War. We settled the issue of slavery and federal sovereignty. So in some ways, it's very obvious how war shapes the national identity. We often elect hero generals to the presidency, beginning with George Washington. We often think our greatest presidents are war leaders, most notably Abraham Lincoln. And in part, this is the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt. He's remembered for fighting the Great Depression, but also fighting the Second World War. But in a less obvious way, every generation of Americans, unfortunately, have had to fight a major war. And we think of ourselves in many ways as a people that don't like war. We don't, for example, through much of our history, we don't require individuals to serve in the military. Yet every generation we go to war. And war becomes a way that individuals serve their country. And often they use that military service, not in a bad way, but they often use that way to say we are citizens because of our military service. So, for example, Irish and Germans, immigrants to the United States in the Civil War, fought in the Civil War, and they said to other Americans, we are full Americans, we served our country in war. In the First World War, immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europeans served in the military, served in World War I, and they said after the war, we too are Americans. After all, we served in our war. We served in the war to end all wars. And when we build war memorials, when we commemorate the holidays, we not only remember the wars, but we also use them to define who is an American by partly honoring those who serve in wartime.
I see. Well, in that sense, then, have these different groups influenced the manner in which we memorialize war?
Yes, I mean, I think one of the big changes that's occurred is the rise of veterans organizations as mass-based organizations. The first veterans organization was only for officers. The Continental Army officers restricted membership in the Society of Cincinnati to their own ranks. They didn't ask privates to join. But beginning really with the Civil War, you have these mass-based veterans organizations that include a large cross-section of individuals from different social classes and even from different regions. You have rural Americans from Maine, but also city dwellers in New York. And the American Legion in the 20th century very much holds itself as a veterans organization open both to Native Americans, Native-born Americans, but also to the new immigrant who has embraced Americanism. And we see the pattern in who gets depicted in war memorials. Even though African Americans made up about 11% of the Union Army in the Civil War, there are very few monuments to them. But part of the legacy of the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s and 70s, you see in the Vietnam memorials that were built in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, African Americans are often depicted in those memorials. So one of the patterns we've seen with this Vietnam memorial is monuments are becoming more inclusive, including representing the different ethnic and racial groups that served their country.
Yes, I notice along those lines the new memorial to the Buffalo Soldiers in Kansas, and recently we saw medals being given to black soldiers from World War II, arguably that they had been overlooked. Is this along the lines of what you're speaking?
Yes, I think there's been a. How we remember things very much shapes what we think the current society will be. And in the 19th century, we largely exclude, even though African Americans were an important part of the military, particularly in the Civil War, we largely excluded them from memory. Whereas we've increasingly recognized their contributions, but we've also recognized a vision for America that's more inclusive. And this process applies to other groups. It applied to Italian American war veterans and Jewish American war veterans after the First World War. when some thought, could Italian Americans or Jewish Americans be good Americans?
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, when we look at these different groups, ethnic groups, racial groups, and memorializing wars, I mean, what are some examples of the ways in which we have actually memorialized?
Well, one of the most common ways is the statue. And for example, in the late 19th century, there's a real wave to build wave of monument building to the American Revolution. The Civil War is the first war where the survivors of the war thought it was important to build memorials, large numbers of monuments and memorials. And they also, that same generation, also sort of made up for lost steam. They sort of took on the responsibility also building memorials to the American Revolution. And in fact, a lot of ethnic groups, Polish Americans, Italian Americans, Irish Americans, build more memorials to their heroes from the American Revolution. And you have a series of them built in Washington, D.C., but also in cities and towns all across the country, to individuals like Pulaski, to Commodore Barry, to other ethnic heroes in the Revolution. I should also say there's a real in building memorials and in commemorating war, there's also a real sense that veterans have a special claim on American society, have a special place of honor. And there's a remarkable consensus that's reached back to the 1820s and 30s. Veterans of the American Revolution were the first group in American society to get direct federal aid in the form of pensions, before any other group really had a claim on the federal treasury when they were in need. One of the largest expenditures for the federal government in the 1880s and 1890s was pension for Civil War veterans. And even in the 20th century, the federal government has been very generous to veterans, and deservedly so, particularly after World War II by creating the GI Bill of Rights. So veterans are also a group that are viewed as being a distinctive group in American society, that have a special claim and special privileges, not only how their sacrifices were remembered in terms of monuments and holidays, but also in terms of real tangible benefits.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, besides statues, you talk about living memorials that became very popular.
Yes. Initially, Americans were very reluctant to build memorials. They thought it was too aristocratic. It smacked of aristocratic Europe. They thought a good Republican society doesn't have memorials. That attitude slowly diminished in the 1820s and 30s and 40s. But it's really, as I said, the Civil War generation that really builds war memorials. And we have sort of the ubiquitous, most southern and northern towns, the soldier, the lone soldier in the village green or the town square. After the First World War, there are a number of doughboy statues that go up, but a lot of people think maybe it's a better idea to build living memorials. In other words, to honor the memory of those who served, the memory of those who died by, for example, planting trees, or building a community house, or building a museum, or providing scholarships. On the other hand, sculptors in particular, and artists, but also a lot of veterans and a lot of civic leaders thought that, no, the proper way to remember and to preserve the memory of war is to build monuments. But it becomes a real fight after World War I between the advocates of living memorials and the advocates of traditional, quote-unquote, traditional statues. And the fight is sort of revisited after the Second World War. What's interesting is the living memorial people really went out after the Second World War. And there are very few monuments built in the Second World War immediately after the war. While you can find it's easy to find in most towns a monument to the First World War or the Civil War, you're hard-pressed to find a memorial dedicated exclusively to the Second World War, particularly a statue. Often Second World War memorials tend to be plaques, and often they're plaques on auditoriums or on schools or on highways.
Oh, yes, you get the Veterans Stadium,
yes.
The Memorial Stadium.
Or the Veterans Memorial Highway,
mm-hmm.
Or the Veterans Park.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is after there are also very few memorials built to the Korean War, but after Vietnam, you almost have the resurrection of the traditional statue and monument in new forms. Vietnam has a large numbers of monuments built to commemorate that conflict. There are, I would dare say there are more monuments, traditional in the form of statues or other artistic monuments to the Vietnam War than there are to the Second World War. Most monuments to the Second World War are living memorials.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the most poignant memorials to most Americans is the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. How and why did this originate?
The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier has, in many ways, a very complex history. There is, at Arlington Cemetery, not too far away from the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, there's the Tomb of the Unknown from the Civil War, which is a mass grave marked by a memorial to the thousands of unidentified bodies from the Civil War. The Unknown Soldier partly owes its creation to the fact that the Army by World War I gets very good at identifying the war dead. That is because of dog tags, because of much more efficient burial details and grave registration services. Most soldiers, when they're killed, their identity isn't lost from them. And their bodies either remain buried in Europe in a military cemetery, or those bodies are repatriated and brought back to the United States. But they're still unknown soldiers. They're still bodies that are not identified. But they're far fewer than in previous wars, which makes them very, very unique and exceptional. But there's also, in World War I, there was a real effort to create war memorials that could unify the nation, because World War I was a very controversial war, probably the most controversial war of the 20th century for Americans. And the idea developed initially in Europe, but came to the United States, the notion that we were going to select one unidentified body and make him the representative American, and make him the representative common soldier. And he symbolized all the soldiers who died in the First World War. And you can't give a state funeral to every soldier. It would partly lose its meaning, but you can, if you pick one identified body, you can give a state funeral, and he can be a proxy for all those soldiers who died, both known and unknown. And by being unknown, you can make him the perfect American. He can be the loyal American who dies without complaining, who willingly went to battle, who willingly went over the top. What's interesting about the unknown soldier, it's Americans really grab onto the concept of the unknown soldier, partly because different groups thought the unknown soldier could be one of their own. Native-born Americans thought he's a good Protestant from a good community in Vermont, whereas someone growing up in the Lower East Side of New York could think he's one of our own. He could be someone who hung out on the Bowery. Someone from Nebraska could think he's the son of a wheat farmer. A Native American could think from a reservation in South Dakota could think he's one of their own. African Americans. And mm-hmm. so it's because he's unknown, he could be any American, but he could be all Americans.
All Americans at the same time.
I think mm-hmm. Americans grab onto that concept.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Kurt Peeler from Rutgers University, for a very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
On Veterans Day, we don't honor just men. Women have bravely served this country as well. But should they be in combat? That's the subject of this week's radio op-ed, provided us by Connie Reeves, historian and retired Army officer. Before becoming an historian, Reeves was a helicopter pilot and intelligence officer in the U.S. Army. She's currently writing her autobiography titled, Don't Cry in the Cockpit.
Should women be in combat? When I was an Army helicopter pilot, I always found it very curious that I could have flown troops into and out of a hostile landing zone, all the time being vulnerable to any aircraft missiles and artillery fire, but that the Army wouldn't let me fly an attack helicopter. In other words, it was very clear to me and my female compatriots that we could be shot at, but we couldn't do the shooting. In the last few years, combat flying positions have been grudgingly open to women, as have positions aboard combat ships. Military women still aren't permitted, however, to do every job. The more grunt-like the role, the less likely that women can be found in it. For example, women can fly attack helicopters in the Army but can't drive tanks. Sometimes the argument is that women aren't physically capable to change a tank tread all by themselves. Then again, men aren't either. Another argument is that women would destroy the close male bonding found in combat units. This has been discredited repeatedly by mixed-gender guerrilla forces in World War II, as well as in Desert Storm. There's also the age-old argument that Americans can't bear the idea of our women coming home in body bags. Military women have died in all of our wars. Our nation has survived their loss. Many people envision women fighting from foxholes and wielding bloody bayonets. We're not likely to ever see again the trench warfare that decimated men in World War I. Our soldiers don't venture out onto the battlefield by foot. They're inside armored personnel carriers or tanks or self-propelled artillery, nor do they linger in foxholes. The battlefield is too fluid and ranges too far. Most battlefield operations today actually take place at a distance far from bombs and artillery. The issue of what women can and should do in the military is not new. During the Civil War, male nurses and doctors were adamant that women nurses didn't belong in military hospitals and gave them the most menial tasks to perform. During World War I, women took over the male roles of typist, secretary, and ambulance driver, but not without grumbling from the men they ousted, I mean freed for the front. Over 350,000 women served in the American military during World War II, but they had to endure a slander campaign that impugned their morals and reputations. Not all countries have been as queasy as the U.S. on this issue. In World War I, after the February Revolution when men refused to fight, Russia created the infamous Women's Battalions of Death that fought directly on the front lines. In World War II, Russia had three squadrons of women pilots that flew fighter and fighter-bomber missions against the Germans. Some of these night witches, as the Germans call them, were fighter aces. Innumerable examples exist around the world and through the centuries of women wielding battle axes, leading armies, and shooting sniper rifles. Nevertheless, by far the largest group of women to have served in combat are military nurses. When our great-grandmothers were still wearing buttoned-up collars, long sleeves, long dresses, and high-top shoes, 23,000 American women nurses served in World War I, many of them close to French front lines. 200 female military nurses landed on Anzio beaches in World War II, on the same day as the assault troops. Six of them died evacuating patients during a German bombing raid, and four were awarded the Silver Star. A total of 83 female Army and Navy nurses were prisoners of war in World War II, most of them in Japanese camps for over 3 years. In Korea and Vietnam, wounded men had a very high chance of survival because female nurses served aboard hospital ships close to the action and near fire bases. Not only have nurses always been susceptible to enemy action, but they've usually seen more of war's tragedy than the average soldier. Nurses are the last person a dying soldier sees, and nurses see many deaths on their watch, carrying that emotional pain long after the ceasefire begins. Don't think women should be in combat? Try imagining a war without female nurses.
You've been listening to Connie Reeves, historian, intelligence officer, and U.S. Army helicopter pilot. For our historic site of the week, we return to Professor Kurt Peeler, whom we interviewed earlier in the show, and his oral history archives of World War II. Here to describe the archives is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Rutgers Oral History Archives of World War II was established on the 50th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, which sparked the realization that those that fought in that war were about to pass from the scene, taking with them their many valuable personal memories, unless their stories were recorded for generations to come. Under the direction of G. Kurt Peeler, the Archives is recording veterans' stories for generations to come. An ongoing process, Peeler and his staff intend to preserve the original interview tapes and edited transcripts, as well as to encourage veterans to donate their personal papers and memorabilia. The Archives will make all of its materials available to the public through books, radio and television documentaries, and museum exhibits. To learn more about the Oral History Archives of World War II, contact Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, or access the Archives website through the Rutgers University homepage.
Thank you, Cindy. And for those looking for further information on World War II, I recommend a virtual exhibit at the National Museum of American History, titled Produce for Victory. The website shows posters used to help mobilize the United States for war. Inexpensive, accessible, and ever-present, posters were an ideal agent for making war aims the personal mission of every American, to volunteer to fight and to boost production of the goods needed to wage the war. To find Produce for Victory, access the National Museum of American History's homepage and its list of exhibits. And finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, we call to your attention a new Ken Burns documentary on Frank Lloyd Wright that will air on November 10th on PBS. The documentary, which will be shown in two segments on consecutive evenings, tells the story of an American artistic legend who designed more than 800 buildings, interspersed with recordings of Wright speaking, architectural drawings, and commentary by colleagues and students. The program explores Wright's personal life as well. Check your local listings for more specific information. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our show and that you'll join us next week when we take a look at the fate of women in the Holocaust. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. ¶¶